Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I knew and I wanted bars to be creative on their own, and they should be as creative as I feel like making the spirit was a creative process, so...
That's Matt Kohlglaser, creator of America's first spirit made from sweet sorghum. I meet up with him at The Rail in Bloomington, Indiana, to taste a couple unique cocktails made with the stuff. We'll have two more recipes from Chef Daniel Orr for a Japanese spinach salad and a cold curried carrot soup. And before that, we look to the Pacific Northwest for a story from Martha Baskin of Green Acre Radio. Community members have transformed the roof of a parking garage in urban Seattle into a garden. Stay with us. Welcome to Mia Partlow, the bringer of our weekly foodie news update. Hello, hello.
Hi there. We're leading off this week's news headlines again with an update on the Farm Bill, or should I say the Agriculture Reform, Food and Jobs Act of 2012. Yes, there's so much more to this bill than just farm regulation. A story this week from the blog grist.org outlines five amendments proposed by U.S. senators that we should be keeping an eye on. For one, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York has proposed restoring funding to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps. The current iteration of the bill would cut the program by $4.5 billion. Two amendments are hoping to limit the subsidies to crop insurance. In recent years, the heaviest farm subsidies shifted away from direct payments to commodity farmers and toward crop insurance premiums. In 2011, taxpayers shelled out $8.9 billion to support crop insurance. Also, make note of the amendment that would ban ownership of livestock by meatpackers and a proposal to restore funding for young farmer programs. You can find a link to the complete article on their website, grist.org. An E. coli outbreak has sickened 14 and killed one across the southern U.S., but the CDC is unclear what the source of the bacteria is. The earliest incident of the illness was discovered on April 15th and the most recent on June 4th. And phase two of the soda wars is upon us. A couple weeks ago, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced a plan to limit the size of sugary drinks available for sale in food service establishments. Unsurprisingly, the beverage industry isn't sitting back and waiting for its soda to go flat. Coca-Cola and McDonald's have taken to Twitter to express their dismay. And the American Beverage Association, the industry's largest trade group, has announced its intention to combat the ban by collecting data to indicate that New York residents oppose Bloomberg's proposal. You can get even more info about the foodie news and notes taking place throughout the week on our social media platforms, Twitter and Facebook. Add your two cents to the conversation. Just search for Earth Eats.
And check out our website for more news, eartheats.org. Mia Partlow, thank you.
You got it.
Missouri soybeans are exported all over the world, and markets are growing. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Eva Doe visited the self-proclaimed world capital of soybeans, Norburn, Missouri, to learn how local farmers are building on connections to their largest customers.
Here in Norburn, Missouri, about 60 miles east of Kansas City, Ron Gibson has spent his entire life growing soybeans on his farm by the river.
I quit college and came back to farm, and I've been farming ever since, and just been adding acres as I go.
At age 70, Gibson got to see for the first time where most of his crop ends up. That is, on the other side of the world, in China.
We spent a couple days in Beijing and then went to the Hebei province, which they call that the sister state to Missouri. And they treated us very, very nice there.
Gibson was part of a Missouri trade mission to China last fall. He represented soybean farmers. It was an important role because soybeans are Missouri's main crop, and China is an important customer.
China imports more soybeans than anybody else in the world. Price wouldn't be near what it is if they weren't using all that they're using.
Historically speaking, it's actually an interesting reversal, China buying so much soy from the U.S. Soybeans are native to China and have been cultivated there for thousands of years. They weren't introduced to the West until much later, and even then, Gibson says, soybeans didn't take off.
It evolved over the years. It started out as a legume, as a manure crop. You planted it and plowed it under. That was years ago, but it turned out it was such a good livestock feed.
With the discovery of new uses for soybeans, like biodiesel, places like Norbert, Missouri have been turning out more soy, and Missouri farmers are looking to China to buy.
You got to find new demands because if the yields are increasing and you don't want to glut on the market. There's soybeans.
In almost every sector, Missouri businesses see opportunity in China. Tim Nowak is executive director of the World Trade Center St. Louis. He says even small local companies are looking overseas.
80 to 85% of Missouri's exporters are small to medium-sized companies. It's not just about the large multinational company.
Missouri exports to China hit new highs last year and are projected to keep growing. During the trade mission Gibson took part in, Governor Jay Nixon signed a $4.4 billion trade deal with China. But not everyone's happy with what's being sold. Robert Scott is director of trade research at the D.C.-based Economic Policy Institute. He points out that Missouri's top export continues to be commodities, such as crops and metals, while its main imports are finished products. He says this trade imbalance will hurt the state in the long run.
Essentially, we're pouring energy on the land and mining the soil for corn with a lot of heavy equipment, and it doesn't create very many jobs. And we're using those products to buy labor-intensive manufactured goods from China.
But as for Gibson with a soybean farm, he sees more opportunity than downside. He says he was struck by something during his visit to China.
I expected everything to be backwards, but the big cities look like just like they do here, only they're huge.
Huge cities filled with potential customers. I'm Eva Doe for Harvest Public Media.
There's a new craft spirit on the market that can claim 100% homegrown Indiana status. Sorghum, America's first sweet sorghum spirit. Creator Matt Colglazier is a spirits enthusiast who decided to take his hobby to the next level.
Hi, Annie.
Hi.
Through his American Craft Spirits website, he's tasted spirits from all over the country, none of which were using sorghum.
And at that point, that's where my idea kind of came in and was like, well, this is a homegrown sugar source. Why is nobody making this into booze?
Colglazier speculates that potential distillers may have been deterred by how labor-intensive it is to prep sorghum. It looks like corn, but is taller and has no ears. Sorghum grows like sugarcane, so the juice is in the stalk. The stalks are dried out and then pressed in a mill. Then the sugar is boiled, similarly to how maple syrup is prepared.
The only people who did it were like farmers who were probably not drinkers and Amish people who are definitely not drinkers. So you had a product that's like the only people who want to make this are people who have like an incredible work ethic and no time for leisure. And go to bed at 6 o'clock. So, none of those people were like, hey, let's turn this into booze. So that was my job.
When he first started forming the idea 2 years ago, he wanted to plant his own sorghum. But he scratched that and eventually got in touch with an Amish farmer who lives near Bromar, Indiana.
You know, when I first approached him about it, I said, well, where do you get seeds for something like this? And he goes, oh, those seeds? Those have been in my family for 48 years. So that's like some of these mills that have been reclaimed are like 110 years old. I mean, they don't make new sorghum mills because it's a very old-timey thing. And in case of the Amish, that's even more unmechanized because, I mean, really nothing more than a simple machine ever touches any of this from the time it's a seed to the time it's actually in the bottle. So that's like to give you a perspective on what I'm trying to do and then the people that I'm trying to work with. It's a very weird and interesting thing.
The next step required collaboration as well, because unlike beer and wine, you can't produce spirits for beverage purposes out of your own home. So we joined forces with Stuart Hobson, the owner of Heartland Distilling in Indianapolis.
I had to partner up with Stuart because he had the equipment, he had the still. You know, when he tasted that first batch and we were just thrilled and excited about how interesting it tasted. We were both sold. It's like tequila, but it's not. It's like white rum, but it's not. It's really its own flavor profile. It's sweet, it's earthy.
One of the few places you can order a drink made with sorghum is The Rail in Bloomington.
My name is Benjamin Zemmel.
or Ben, you can call me Ben, and my title here is bartender.
Ben is going to be mixing a couple cocktails for us, which incorporates sorghum. He says it works best in a sour, which is 2 ounces of liquor to a half ounce of sweetener and 3/4 of an ounce of acid. From that basic formula, you can then get creative however you like.
It always makes things interesting when we can work off of a new product, you know, something that's not, you know, the same thing done over and over and over again, but something that's really original. Okay, so we're going to start with something that people can actually make at home on their own, and this is going to be a sorghum sour. So we start off with 2 ounces of sorghum. Both of these cocktails will be using the white sorghum. Then we're going to use simple syrup, which is a 2-to-1 mixture of water to sugar. So what we're going to do is use a 1/2 ounce of this, and we're going to use some fresh squeezed lemon juice, and you're going to want to use 3/4 of an ounce. And then finally, we're going to put 1 white of an egg. It'll give the drink a little bit of personality, make it light and fluffy, and have a great texture. Cool. So then we serve these in a coupe and a sidecar glass. And what you're going to want to do is, all this is done in your shaker, your 16-ounce shaker. You're going to fill that up with ice. Fill it to the very, very top. We're going to put that in our 23-ounce shaker and just shake it like crazy. And then we're going to double strain this into the glass. Typically, when you're shaking a drink, little pieces of ice break up into that. When you double strain, what you do is you minimize the amount of ice that's going to be in that drink, so you have less water and more, you know, spirit and acid and sweet and all that good stuff. And as you can see, this is a very fluffy drink.
You had this drink?
I have, yeah. I think the basic sour is the best. It's one of the best things for it. Again, like a simple margarita works really well with it. Anything lemon, anything lime, perfect.
For a garnish, what we can use is a little bit of Angostura bitters and just drop it around the drink. And then with a little bar straw, you can make a pretty little design. And our cocktail is finished.
Cheers.
Okay, so the next drink that we're going to do is called the Hellfire Sorghum Sour. And the reason that it's called the Hellfire Sorghum Sour is because we use this Bitterman's Hellfire Habanero Shrub in it, which is quite spicy.
And this is not going to be an ingredient that people have in their homes.
Generally,
probably.
No. You're not going to find most people with the Hellfire Shrub at their house, as well as Orgeat Syrup, which is an almond sweetener. Orgeat. So just like the other cocktail, we're going to start with 2 ounces of the sorghum, the light sorghum. And instead of simple syrup this time, we're going to use 1/2 ounce of the Orgeat syrup. In this sour, we're gonna use both lemon and lime juice. So you're going to want to do 1/3 of an ounce of each one. So this is where the Hellfire comes in. So we're going to put 1/3 of an eyedropper of this Hellfire shrub into the Hellfire sorghum sour. And then again, we're going to do the white of 1 egg. Just like the other one, we're going to fill up our 16-ounce shaker with ice, and we are going to shake it.
Should have been timing you. Do you just do this, like, as long as you feel like it?
Well, you can actually kind of tell how well it's being shaken by how cold the shaker gets, so you can kind of feel it as you go.
So again, with the double straining.
Exactly. We're going to double strain this again so we don't get little chips of ice in our cocktail.
So now this one's going to be spicy.
This one's going to have some heat to it, yes. But you'll still be able to taste the integrity of the sorghum in there. Well, we've got quite a bit here. And just like the other, we're going to do another garnish. This time we're going to use Hellfire Habanero Shrub. Just going to drop that around the cocktail a few different places. And we're also going to use some Angostura bitters, mainly for color. Take another little bar straw, and we have our finished cocktail.
Actually, I've not tried this drink, so I'm kind of curious to...
Ooh.
Yeah, I like it. You know, it's really interesting how dry that tastes on the end, on the finish. So it's a different, you know, antidote to, like, a lot of the sweeter cocktails that are out there. You know, you're not just drinking... You don't feel like you're just drinking sugar and booze.
thanks to Ben Zemel and Matt Kohlglaser. See recipes for both of these cocktails and check out the photos from our afternoon at the Rail. Our website is eartheats.org. And if you're intrigued by sorghum, check out their website at sorghum.com. In the kitchen now with Chef Daniel Orr. Soon, all the beautiful greens being sold at the farmer's market early in the season will be replaced by corn and fruit and tomatoes and all sorts of good things. So let's enjoy a big bag of spinach while we still can. This is our Japanese spinach salad.
We've got some soy sauce, a couple teaspoons of fish sauce, about a teaspoon of toasted sesame oil, and you can get those really in any big supermarket, but definitely at any ethnic market. They're kind of your secret arsenal. Add them to any of your dishes, and all of a sudden they start to taste a little more exotic. Basically, fish sauce is anchovies, fresh anchovies that are dried, and then they're covered with water and in barrels, and then left in the sun for about a year.
Doesn't that sound tasty, folks?
And it does smell strong, but it tastes great. And if you like Thai food, Vietnamese food, there's usually a little bit of fish sauce in those dressings. The sesame oil is made with white sesame seeds that are toasted and then pressed, so you get a toasted sesame flavor. So that's how that's made. About 2 tablespoons of sesame seeds. We're going to add some scallions. I'd say about three or four scallions. Okay, and then finally I'm going to add some ginger. Probably add about a teaspoon and a half. I'm cutting the ginger across the grain.
And you're not taking time to peel it?
No, when the ginger is young and the skin is smooth, you don't really need to peel it. Now, this is a dish you don't want to add like a citrus or lemon juice to it because it's going to discolor your spinach. You could always add a little bit at the end if you wanted to, but I don't think it's really necessary. Okay, we're going to toss our spinach in this.
That's what you're looking for?
Yeah, delicious.
If you're the DIY sort, check out our recipe for vegan fish sauce. Find that along with a slew of other recipes using greens and a new recipe for a simple basil quinoa salad from our blogger Natalie Ray Good. That's garnering a lot of buzz with our Twitter followers. Find all of that and so much more on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up, community members in a Seattle neighborhood wanted to build a public garden.
But there just really wasn't any vacant land. And we didn't have the budget to purchase a lot in this area, so we started looking at parking lots.
Martha Baskin of Green Acres Radio has a story about the 40,000 acres of growing space on the top of a parking garage in Seattle's Queen Anne neighborhood. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Spinach has vitamin A, B, and D, but spinach never appealed to me. But one day while having dinner with a guy, I decided to give it a try. I didn't like it the first time, it was so new to me.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. The abnormally warm spring and the recent dry spell are taking a toll on southern Indiana farmers. WFIU's Lauren Glapa reports.
Jenny Haney of Unique Sheep Farm in Seymour says the lack of rain has destroyed her entire celery crop and prevented her from planting edamame.
It's affecting us in a small way by comparison to what if this continues, it will be devastating. I mean, there won't be anything to sell.
Many produce farmers already dealt with one devastating blow this year. The warm spring, followed by an unexpected frost, cost many grape and apple farmers at least part of their crop. Paul Anderson owns Anderson Orchards in Mooresville.
Well, dry spell hadn't hurt us, but the freeze coming out so early, we started out about 6 weeks earlier than normal, which is unbelievable. And I've been in this business 50 years, and I've never seen it that early.
Blooming Foods produce buyer Ruth Faree says that when growers lose part of their crops, prices usually go up. She says this hasn't happened yet, but she thinks an increase on Indiana-grown produce is likely.
We handle a variety of products that we have to have here at all times, and, you know, we hope and pray that we can have local, but if we can't, then we have to go through other sources.
Droughts seen in the past two growing seasons have occurred later in the summer, but a drought beginning in June has the potential to be especially devastating. For WFIU News, I'm Lauren Guapa.
Fifty years ago, when the Seattle Center was built for the World's Fair, the future promised a space-age car culture. Today, the roof of an on-site parking lot hopes to be a demo pilot for a new future: how to grow food and green space under the Seattle skyline. Martha Baskin of Green Acres Radio has our report.
From the street below this five-story parking garage, you'd never suspect watermelons and tomatoes might soon ripen on the vine. This is the land of hard surfaces and high-rises. But weather permitting, a bountiful harvest is what volunteers, designers, and city planners have in mind. This is the Up Garden on Mercer Street, a living and breathing rooftop garden. It will not only grow food and contain rain runoff, but grow community and even an art car. Landscape designer Nicole Kistler points to a 1963 Ford Galaxy that will boast a planter.
We hope to see watermelons and pumpkins and corn and sunflowers popping through the roof, so it will look like the car has exploded, and we're calling it the Growing Galaxy.
Kistler and design partner Eric Higby were thrilled at the opportunity to design one of the country's first public rooftop gardens at scale. 40,000 square feet of space will yield up to 120 plots. Dozens of undulating terraces crisscross the garage. Kistler says she and Higby drew on agricultural models from all over the world.
Rice paddy terraces and contour plowing on slopes, and we thought about a blanket kind of wrinkled up to create and hold the soil.
She points to filter fabric lining the sides of planters made from sustainably harvested cedar. The pace at which the public roof garden is going up is unprecedented for city pea patches. From conception to completion, it's been about 7 months, with volunteers doing most of the heavy lifting. Monies from a 2008 Parks and Green Space levy called for an edible garden in dense, garden-hungry Queen Anne.
But there just really wasn't any vacant land.
Laura Raymond is with the Department of Neighborhood's Pea Patch program.
And we didn't have the budget to purchase a lot in this area, so we started looking at parking lots.
The Mercer Street garage caught their attention. Publicly owned, it fit with a city goal of growing food in public spaces. The Up Garden also fits with making the city more livable and sustainable, says Joel Bonslaben, sustainable strategy specialist with Seattle Public Utilities. A core objective of green roofs is to capture rain runoff before it hits hardscapes.
Filter it, slow that flow, and treat it before it enters Elliott Bay, Lake Washington, and the other bodies of water in the region.
Green roofs have seen triple-digit growth nationwide, growing 115% in 2011, according to Green Roofs for Healthy Cities, a nonprofit committed to the marriage of green roofs and urban agriculture.
And what we're seeing now is that developers are incorporating this in their business model. They're putting gardening amenities on the roof so that residents or local businesses can grow food and either take it right to their dinner table or take it right to their restaurant or grocery store.
For the hundreds of volunteers who've built the Up Garden, growing food and growing it now is what it's about. Craig Moore has put 100-plus hours into the project.
It's kind of funny. I like to say all I really wanted was a 10-by-10 patch of dirt to grow some stuff on. And we thought, when we heard it, was like, pea patch coming to the neighborhood. Great, sign me up.
Moore lives in a Queen Anne condo. He knows the people in his building, but that's about it.
So this has been kind of a neat experience to meet people who live, like, throughout the neighborhood.
Bonnie, another volunteer, says growing food goes with growing community. She points to a pea patch that was raised to accommodate her needs.
It's an ADA pot, so I can sit in my walker.
Bonnie will be the project manager for children's activities and growing food for food banks.
That's required for part of our charter.
The pea patch charter, that is. Volunteer Ryan Miller is a chef at Fair Start. He plans to secure a plot for the downtown cooking rehab program.
I think that it'd be really nice to get some food growing in addition to cooking. And I mean, if we start with some herbs or some kale, then we can say that we grew it too.
50 years ago, the Mercer Street Garage was built for the World's Fair.
1962, it looked like space-age car culture.
Again, Laura Raymond with the city's PPATCH program.
And so now here we are looking to the future. And for us, that looks like urban gardening. So, it's fun. There's a new life here.
Hear more reports from Martha Baskin about the environmental and sustainability movement from Green Acre Radio, Jack Straw Productions, and KBCS on their website, greenacreradio.blogspot.com.
It seems sort of counterintuitive to be doing a special on soups in the summertime.
Well, in the Caribbean, where I worked for a couple of years, they hated cold soup. They liked hot soup. So they would have their pumpkin soup in the middle of the summer, with some scotch bonnets and things that make you sweat a little bit. And then those cool breezes in the islands come by and they help you cool down. Same thing with curries in India and spicy dishes in Thailand. All those areas, they love spicy food because they actually do help you cool down. They also, all of these soups would be great on top of pasta, so they would make good pasta sauces. Any of those blended soups that are kind of creamy and have that creamy texture, you can use for pasta sauce as well.
Here's Chef Daniel Orr's recipe for curried carrot and fennel soup.
So we've got some peeled carrots. I'm just going to cut them right into the pan.
And you did peel these.
Did peel them. We're going to add to the carrots a quart of water. And then we're going to add the other flavorings. We're going to add some orange zest. Okay, and then we're going to squeeze the half orange into the mixture. Okay, and since this is a curried soup, we're going to add some of those really nice Indian flavors. Fresh ginger, some garlic, about a toe of garlic, about a teaspoon of lemon zest, our curry powder, and I'm using a mild curry powder.
All the colors in this bowl are orange or yellow or...
Yeah, and then we've got the turmeric, turmeric is a member of the ginger family. It's a root, and it's what gives curry the yellow color, but it's also a great antioxidant, so it's great to get into your diet. And we're going to add just a little bit of honey. We've got some thyme over here we picked out in the garden earlier. And then we're going to cook this until the carrots get very tender. It's important that they cook all the way through so the blender can puree them. If you want to make this soup vegan, instead of putting the heavy cream in that we're going to do, you could also add some coconut milk. But we're going to use some heavy cream. Not much, just going to add a quarter to a half cup. And what that's going to do is just give a nice color. You see how that's made it a lighter color? And then when we puree it, it's going to turn beauteous.
Check out this recipe and another one for broccoli basil soup on our website, eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, Massage and Yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Next week on Earth Eats, we speak with a couple who turned a hobby into a profession. The bread from Muddy Fork Bakery is super delicious. Be sure to come back for that. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.